This is an interview with Brooke Bouchon, who served with the Air Force in Iraq and Jordan. This interview is being conducted at Brooke's home on the following date, August 17th, 2008. The interviewer is Catherine Plain. Okay, tell me about your background and life circumstances before you entered the military.
Before I entered the military, I had graduated from nursing school and had been working at the VA hospital for about a year. I lived in Madison. My family had moved away, so I was here by myself and decided that I wanted to travel. But I didn't feel that 1 year of nursing experience was enough, so decided that another way to be able to travel was to be able to join the military.
So you joined in Madison?
Yep, joined in Madison. It was kind of a spontaneous decision. I was sitting at work one night, and all the patients were asleep. So I was surfing some things on the internet, and I had the week before received something from the Navy offering to have me come out and tour one of their ships out in California and trying to recruit me. And I'm like, well, I'm terrified of water, so I would never be interested in the Navy. But it got me thinking about, maybe it would be kind of cool to serve in the military. And back my freshman year in college, I had served in Air Force ROTC, but had dropped out after 1 year. So I'd already had some interest in the military, but I had just, I'd been afraid to kind of commit myself to it. So sitting there in the middle of the night, I sent in a thing to request to have a recruiter contact me. Next day, somebody called me, and within a week, I had signed up.
And what year was this?
This was back in 2001.
Okay.
So it would have been like springtime. Then I had to go through all the MEPs and all that kind of stuff. So I got commissioned on the July 3rd, 2001. But then I actually entered active duty on September 2nd in 2001. So that summer was just kind of getting ready for everything and figuring out what I was going to do about my house and letting my job know that I was leaving. It was quite a chaotic summer, but it was exciting too. I didn't want to wait any longer than I had to, so as soon as there was another class coming up for officer training, I was like, get me in that class. I don't want to wait another 6 months or whatever it was to be able to get into the next class.
And you were able to be an officer because you had a college degree, right?
Correct. Okay. Yeah, there are certain professions. I was with a bunch of doctors, lawyers, chaplains, dentists, and then nurses. Those are the ones that can that are commissioned prior to going to training.
So, how did your family react to it?
Well, my family was actually very supportive. My mom was surprised, but she said she had a feeling that I would probably make some sort of major life decision that year. She said, you can tell I was just kind of antsy, and I had been looking for what it was I was supposed to be doing with my life. I was kind of watching for signs. She kept telling me that I would have a sign. And so I told her this was what I was being told to do. She was not as okay with it after September 11th happened, and she realized that I was going to be going probably overseas, but they were still very supportive. My friends thought I was insane. They thought that I didn't think it through thoroughly. They thought that I was running away from my life. I got all sorts of interesting comments, but I wanted to do something different. I wanted to leave Wisconsin. I wanted to try something else.
And where had you gone to college?
At UW-Madison. So I grew up in Madison, went to school in Madison, and I just wanted to go do something else.
Yeah. So after 2000 and September 11th happened, did you get more worried about your decision, or were you still okay with it?
It's strange. I remember after we were told about the attacks, they pulled all of us inside, and we were walking down a flight of steps. And it was really, really, really quiet in the corridor. I mean, normally everybody's talking and everything, but nobody was talking at all. And it just kind of struck me that this is what I'm here for. This is the type of things that I went into the military for. Because I didn't have them pay for my college education or do anything like that. I actually truly wanted to serve my country. So I'm like, there are how many thousands of people that just got injured. I'm a nurse. This is what I'm supposed to do, is to go take care of people. So it kind of validated why I joined the military. Like, at this point in time, it kind of felt like it happened for a reason.
So you hadn't even done your basic training at this point, right?
No. Nope. I was in the middle of it. So it made things kind of strange. I mean, for 2 weeks of my basic training, all of our teachers were gone. I mean, they deployed just tons of them because we were out in Alabama, so we were close by, and they were all nurses and doctors that were doing our training. So they deployed all of them, and then we kind of sat there and watched CNN on TV every day in an auditorium. And it was weird because you couldn't do any outdoor activity, so we couldn't march, we couldn't practice any of those types of things. At the end of the course, you're supposed to go through like a field exercise. Well, we couldn't do any of those things. So we missed out on some of that kind of stuff. But I think for our group, it really hit home what the military was all about. And it changed everything. You know, we kept hearing before we joined the military, oh, you'll be able to take incentive flights, you'll be able to go to Hawaii or overseas, and, you know, the military is so relaxed. It completely changed that day. They became a lot more strict about things. They wouldn't allow incentive flights because they needed room for cargo and passengers and things like that related to the war effort. So I never knew the military as anything different, but I noticed that a lot of people who had been in for, you know, 10 or 15 years had a really difficult time with the way it changed. When I first got out to Travis, it would have been in October, it would often take an hour or two to get on base because they were searching everybody's cars, they were looking in everything. So you had to leave for work extra early just to make sure you got to work on time, because you never knew how many people they were going to stop, if they were stopping everybody, what was going to happen.
Wow.
That was crazy for a while there.
So why weren't you allowed to go outside?
They were afraid that because we were an officer training school, that we would be a target. Okay. So they just didn't want us to be visible outside as much as possible. The first couple of days, they would actually have us run from place to place. Like, if you had to go to the cafeteria. Well, the first day, they wouldn't even let us out of the building. They fed us MREs. But then the second day, they finally said, okay, you know, we can start to allow people grow in groups of five. And then you have to run to the cafeteria or wherever it was that you were going, from building to building, because they didn't want people outside for a period of time. It was weird.
Wow. I guess as time went on, that they let up on that a little bit.
Yeah, then by the last week, we were finally able to march. Well, then we had drill competition, but we hadn't been able to practice. So it was quite interesting.
So your officer training school, is that what it was?
Mm-hmm.
It was in Alabama, is that what you said?
Yep, so Montgomery.
So you went from Madison to Alabama.
Yep, and then I had to fly home on an airplane after September 11th, like within a couple of weeks. So it was kind of scary. I mean, you can tell at the airports there were a lot of people that were stressed out. But yeah, because then I flew back to Madison, and my parents drove with me from Madison out to California.
So what was officer training school like, besides the not being able to walk from building to building? But
it was mentally challenging. Their whole goal is to make you as tired as you possibly can, and then make you think and make critical decisions. Because it was a lot of, you know, you would get home from your classes at 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and then you'd have a couple hours of homework, and you'd have to iron your uniform for the next day. So it wasn't anywhere near as physically challenging as what enlisted personnel go through, but when you're then waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you've only had 4 hours of sleep, and you're doing that every single day, and then they're, you know, throwing case scenarios at you or putting you out in a... Before, they every once in a while would take a couple of us out to it's like a training camp type thing, where you would not be able to face whatever the activity was behind you, and they would give you a scenario. Like, for example, you've just been dropped in a minefield. There are five of you. The only supplies that you have are this rope and, you know, a bucket. You need to be able to get from here to the other side of the minefield within the next 10 minutes because you're being chased. And so then you would have to turn around and complete the task. And they were watching your leadership skills, your ability to delegate things to other people, all of that kind of stuff, trying to work on that. But when you've only had 4 hours of sleep per night for the last, like, month, it gets really hard to think straight.
I'm sure.
So there were a lot of us that were just really, 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 really tired. And then on the weekends, you'd be, you know, studying or whatever, because there was lots of papers and lots of tests and stuff like that.
Was it tests on nursing stuff, or was it...
It was all Air Force stuff.
Okay.
Because most people, basic training is 12 weeks. For us, it was 6 weeks. But we still had to learn everything that we could about the military, military history, what it means to be an officer, all about the different performance appraisal system, all of that stuff they crammed into 6 weeks. So, just a lot of stuff to memorize.
Were you able to meet any people or make any friends while you were there?
I met a lot of people, and when I was there, was friends with them, but I didn't really keep in touch after we left. It was one of those things. There was definitely a division between the doctors and the nurses. We were a lot younger than the doctors, and they treated us like we didn't know as much, even though it was completely nothing related to medicine. This was all military stuff. But they were a lot more assertive. I mean, they were older. They had graduated from medical school. And then the couple of nurses in my group, we were all still kind of like shell-shocked trying to figure out exactly what was going on. So it was just interesting watching the dynamics of our group. Once I got to Travis, discovered that there were a couple people that were in class with me that got stationed at Travis, and so I kept in touch with a couple of them. But the rest of them, it was like, maybe an email a month for a year, and then we didn't really talk after that.
So after you left Alabama, you said you flew back to Madison?
Yep.
So.
And then I drove out to California. My parents came with me and stayed out there with me for the first week trying to find a place to live. That was probably the most nerve-wracking part of things because I just wanted everything to be settled so that I could focus on learning my new units and what was going to be happening there. But I was given, I can't remember how many days, but a couple of days to be able to search for an apartment. And every place that I was finding was either too expensive or they weren't going to have an apartment available for another, 2 months or things like that. So I finally found one that was fairly close to base. And one of the girls that I was in officer training, her apartment wasn't going to be ready yet, so she actually stayed with me for that first, I think it was the first month that we were out there. So it was really nice because she was also a nurse. She worked at the hospital. And I didn't feel like I was so alone. I was used to having a huge group of friends and lots of people to go hang out with, and it wasn't like that out there. It was the first time I'd ever been, completely on my own. I had to learn how to go to the grocery store by myself and little things like that that I had taken for granted because I had roommates forever. But when I first got to my unit and checked in, my commander had actually been deployed. So I had 60% of the staff. So there were not a lot of people left behind. So they were struggling with staffing and trying to figure out how to take care of things back stateside. They ended up combining the medical and the surgical ICUs together to be able to staff it better rather than having two nurses on one side of the department and then two on the other. It actually ended up being a good thing for me because I was cross-trained then to all medical and surgical patients rather than specializing in just one area.
Were you specialized, or was it?
I wasn't an ICU nurse at all before I went into the military. They were the ones who trained me. Training wasn't that great, but because I joined at such a strange time, my preceptor was really, really good, but I only had, 6 weeks of orientation, and I was a brand new ICU nurse, and I didn't really get a lot of critical patients while I was in orientation. So then the day that I got off of orientation, I had one of these patients that was, you know, so sick that I couldn't even turn him to be able to get the bloody sheets out from underneath him because his blood pressure would drop. And I kept asking the other nurses that worked with me for help, and I would get the response that, oh, I'm walking my patient, or I'm giving my patient a bath, or things like that, and nobody would help me. It was very much in the nursing world. People have been around tend to eat their young. Nursing's kind of known for it. And this was one of those departments that was very much like that. So if I wasn't working with my preceptor or with a couple of the nurses that were helpful, my shifts were just terrible. I'd be given to really, really sick patients, and I would be offered no help, and they'd pull the techs from me, so I'd have to do everything by myself. I actually had the surgeon to teach me how to use some of the equipment because I didn't know what I was doing. I was like, okay, I learned a lot of things by reading textbooks. So it was scary, and at the time I hated it. After being in for about 6 months, I wanted to quit, but I couldn't. I mean, I had signed up, and I'm like, I'm going to get through this. And I volunteered for every single class that they possibly would offer to me and read tons of textbooks, and I learned from the people that were willing to teach me. I learned as much as I could. And it actually, when I got deployed then, was a benefit because I was so used to learning things as I was doing it that then, you know, I'd never seen a gunshot wound or a blast injury or anything like severe burns except in a textbook. But I still felt comfortable. I never felt like I was overwhelmed with the patients we were taking care of. I mean, emotionally, yes, but not intellectually. I knew what I was supposed to do, and I knew how to take care of them.
Wow. So it's like being at Travis was really the training for being deployed.
Yeah.
So who were your patients at Travis? Were they...
We had all age groups. We took care of pediatric ICU patients, and then a lot of them were retired vets.
Okay.
Huge portion of them. Most of them were men. We had some female patients, but it was primarily men that were retired vets. We would occasionally get some VA patients, not as often, and then some active duty. But because the ICU is the age group, it was typically the older population, it was primarily retired vets. There's a lot of them in that area around Northern California. When the base in the Philippines closed, a lot of them moved to San Francisco area.
So how long were you at Travis?
Except for my deployments, I was there for my whole 4 years.
Okay, so you just went from there to your deployments and then you came back.
Yep. I had the opportunity to be stationed in Bitburg, Germany, but I would have had to extend my enlistment, extend my time, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do my four and get out, so I opted not to go to Germany.
Were you offered that early?
No, I had already been in for 3 years, I think. Yeah, so I would have had to extend by 2 years and would have been in another three instead of just one more year. At that point, I was ready to just get out.
So what happened, when did you get your first deployment?
So my first deployment would have been, I found out on Valentine's Day in February of 2003, I found out that I was going to be deployed. We were deployed right before major combat operations happened, and they were trying to get us in theater with the hospital set up and ready before they went into Iraq. So it was quite crazy. I got the phone call saying you're being deployed, and it wasn't my turn to be deployed. They go in cycles, and everybody has a specific slot that they're plugged into. But the person that was supposed to go had a back injury, so I got pulled to go for her. My initial thought was, I don't want to go because I'm getting married in May, and I was going to miss my wedding. So I'm like, I freaked out at first. But then I realized that, you know, everything happens for a reason, and then I got excited. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be deployed. I'm going to get to experience something completely different. This is what I've been training for, and this is, you know, why I joined. And my parents were able to fly out and see me, and my fiance at the time and I decided that we would just have a small wedding in Nevada quick before I got deployed, so that if anything happened to me while I was gone, him and our stepchild were protected. So, got married, and a couple days later, got deployed.
So did you go to Iraq, or did you go to Kuwait? Or
Jordan.
Jordan, okay.
Yep, the first time around, we went to Jordan. And our base was set up for primarily search and rescue. We didn't do any combat operations or anything like that out of there. But we're 30 miles west of the Iraqi border.
Okay.
So it was, people would say that when you would go out on the highway, you could actually see the border, but I never went out there. It was interesting being on a Jordanian base, though, because it was actually an active Jordanian military base. So there were actually Jordanian soldiers on base, and because of that, we were not allowed to wear shorts, or the women weren't. Men could, but women were not allowed to wear shorts, tank tops, anything like that that was considered revealing. So it was really hot over there. When we got there, it was snowing, but within like a month, it was like, you know, 120, 130 degrees. So to not be able to wear shorts or tank tops was not very fun. But
so were the men allowed to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the men could, because it wasn't offensive to the Jordanians. And we kept being told that it was for our safety, and I can understand that. I mean, it was a bear base. There wasn't much there. We, you know, we had some porta-potties, some nasty showers. And then we had, you know, I think it was like 25 or 30 people per tent. We slept on army cots. It was a basic deployment. You know, people always think of Air Force deployments as, oh, you're in a hotel someplace and you've got maid service and air conditioning and laundry. And yeah, no, I washed my clothes in the shower with me in the morning and then hung them dry. And by the time I got them off the line, they were typically so full of dust it didn't really make a difference to wash them. My BDUs I would typically wear for a couple weeks before I even bother trying to clean them.
Wow.
Yeah, you just kind of got used to the conditions, and I actually enjoyed that Air Force or that deployment better than my typical Air Force deployment. Because you didn't have a theater and a gym and all that kind of stuff, you really needed to bond with the people you were with. So you had more of an opportunity to talk to them and get to know them, and you felt more like you were connected with the people you were there with.
Yeah. Do you still keep in touch with any of them?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I do.
Do you have any memorable stories or anything like that happened on base?
Let's see. Normally it has something to do with alcohol. One of the single nurses that I was there with, she was enjoying the fact that there were all these men around. And she was dating, or whatever, yeah, as much as you can date in the military out there. I mean, he would like carry her bag for her and stuff like that. But she was dating one of the doctors, and then she met an army pilot who she became interested in. And one night we were out at a little gathering at the army side of things, and the doctor showed up. So Moon freaked out and didn't know what to do, and turned off all the lights and created all sorts of chaos, and of course ended up drawing even more attention to herself in her attempt to hide from him. But yeah, it was a lot of stories like that. That one was longer ago. I feel sorry for people who have to remember even farther. When we first got there, they dropped off all of our supplies on pallets out by the flight line. And we were told that we had to build the hospital like a ways away from there. Well, I mean, they didn't send us with a forklift. So that was quite interesting, finagling a forklift from the Army to be able to move our stuff. And then, because of the way the the landscape and stuff is, we needed to build a wooden platform first to be able to put the tent on top of. And we had one hammer and like a couple of nails and some pieces, old pieces of wood that we managed to get from the Jordanians. But they actually made us take turns with the hammer going through and trying to build this platform to put our tent up on. And of course, we're under this time constraint. They're telling us, you know, you've got 2 days to get your hospital up and running because we're going in regardless of whether you're ready or not. And so we're sitting there going, oh my God, you know. So, and then our pieces of wood started disappearing at night. So then they had us actually doing patrols at night, watching our wood pile to make sure that nobody came. But we didn't have any, I mean, all that we had was a radio. So it would be funny, you know, there'd be two girls sitting out there with the radio because the guys during the day were doing the physical labor. So then the girls had to, at night, watch the wood pile. That was crazy. But I'm like, yeah, next time more than one hammer would be beneficial. And then when we opened all of our supplies, a lot of them were full of mold because they had been packed back in the 1980s.
Really?
A lot of stuff was expired. Yeah, it was interesting.
So what was the main thing that you did while you were on base there?
I primarily worked in the ICU, would help cover in the ER when we'd have casualties come in, or the floor, wherever the patients were, I'd work. And then during the day, because I needed to stay active, you know, if you sit there and you think about things, then that's when it gets difficult to be gone. But I got to know one of the Army dentists. So I actually would go to the little Jordanian clinic with him during the day, because I worked night shift. And learn all about dentistry, so all about the different amalgams and when you take a tooth out. And it was actually quite interesting. I got to meet some of the Jordanian military people that way. He introduced me to a lot of them. Got offered. They have this tea that they drink, and it's considered very, very rude not to accept it. But it's like scalding hot and really, really, really sweet. So it's like you're sitting there trying to sip it to be polite, and it's like, I don't like tea anyways, so I'm like, oh gosh. But one of the really sad stories, we had heard that we were going to be receiving some casualties, and we're waiting and waiting and waiting, and they didn't show up. Well, then finally, probably a couple hours later, a vehicle pulled up, and this guy comes running in, and he's like, you know, hey, you know, my buddy's wounded, you need to come help me. And they, I can't remember how many patients we had, but one of them was gripping an American flag. And he would not let go of the flag. He was just, like, adamant that we not take it away. It was almost frantic, like, screaming at us to get away from him because he needed to keep the flag. And so one of the nurses finally said, you know, what's so important about the flag? You know, we can hold it for you. We can make sure that you get it before you leave, but turned out that on their trip to us, one of his buddies had died. And before he died, he gave him the flag and said, please make sure my family gets this.
Wow.
So he was protecting the flag. So, I mean, there were, it was really sad. There were some of those types of things. And then, you know, you can always tell based on the demeanor of the people that were coming in, what type of experience they'd been through, because we weren't told anything. It was mostly special forces we were taking care of. So we had no idea. They wouldn't even tell us mechanism of injury, which oftentimes was pretty obvious. You know, all their legs are broken. Well, they were probably jumping out of something. but they, sometimes they would come in and they would be like really excited and be like, oh my God, did you see that? And wow. And they'd be talking about wanting, so they'd be really excited and they'd be like chatty and they'd be like, when am I going to be able to get back out there? And you know, you tell them that, you know, they had such severe injuries that they were going to have to go back stateside, be rehabilitated, and they may never make it back out. And they'd be just devastated, saying, no, you don't understand, I have to get back out there, my group needs me, you know, I need to be there with them. And then you'd have other groups that would come through and they would be, you know, completely silent. They wouldn't talk to each other. They wouldn't look at each other. They wouldn't look at you. It's like they were scared shitless. Whatever it was that happened, it didn't happen the way that it was supposed to, and they didn't want to talk about it.
Sure.
So it was very interesting and then you'd watch the news trying to see if you could figure out what happened. You know, oh, hey, we just took over an airport or this or that, and you try and guess what was going on. And of course, you never really knew if that was what it was or not. But it would get complicated, though, because our patients didn't exist. So we didn't know their names, and we didn't know, you know, who they were. I mean, we didn't know anything about, I didn't even know how old they were or where they were from. They were a number. You know, number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Because they were special ops?
Mm-hmm. So, and like when you would go over to the cafeteria to order food, you know, you might have 5 patients, but you'd say you wanted 10 meals. And then the next day you might have 7 patients, so you'd say you wanted 7 meals. And the next day you'd have 2 patients, so you'd say you wanted 8 meals. And so you never wanted to say exactly how many patients were over in the hospital. So we ordered just weird amounts of food, depending upon the day, to kind of cover it. And the patients would be in, you know, a separate ward with the flap closed, and only it was very restricted who could go back there. It was weird. You kept getting this, these people are not here. Not documenting on them. You're not, you know, you could check their vital signs and do all your checks just to make sure they're okay, but you're not documenting anything.
You don't like write it down in a chart or anything?
No. So it would get complicated sometimes trying to keep track. You know, number 1 is taking Zolfa, and number 2 is taking penicillin, and number 3 is allergic to Vicodin. And I mean, it was like, you'd have like some paper, but it wasn't anywhere near as detailed as a chart normally is.
Wow.
Yeah, that was probably the most complicated part. But it was interesting. I mean, I get to meet a lot of really cool Special Forces guys, and I get to fly in Chinook.
What's a Chinook?
It's the helicopter that has the twin blades on the top. We got to know some of the Army colonels really well, and so they took us up on a flight. They had to go out, and we had A-10s, which are the warthogs. They have the huge bullets that shoot tanks. But they had gone out and for some reason had a misfire with one of their rounds. So they had dropped it in the field. So we were out searching for the round in the field to be able to tell EOD so they could go blow it up. And so it was quite fascinating. I got to sit on the edge and put my legs over. Oh, it was like the most amazing experience ever. I fell in love with helicopters on that trip. I mean, I've never experienced anything like that. You know, have you ever been to an IMAX movie before?
Yeah.
And you know how you feel like you're in the movie and you're moving? And that was the kind of sensation you got, except that it was live and it was real. And knowing that you'd fall out was kind of scary, but I mean, it was like amazing. So I liked that. It was probably the highlight of my deployment, was the helicopter ride.
That's cool.
So, I did have a bad experience.
You said you had a bad experience. Do you want to talk about it at all? Or?
No, not really.
Okay, that's fine. So, were the people that you were treating, they were obviously fighting in Iraq.
Yeah.
And they were coming. How long did it take them to get from Iraq to the base to get treated for you, by you guys?
We have no clue because we had no idea where they were coming from. They were just, I mean, and it was one of those things that the whole communication system sucked. Because you'd be told that you're going to get, you know, 4 gunshot wounds and you'd get 3 people with leg injuries that, you know, broken legs. And then, you know, the next day you'd be told you have 2 patients who are, you know, pulseless, non-breathing, and you'd have 2 people walk in. So, I mean, you didn't even know what type of patients you were truly going to get, when they were going to show up, you were constantly on guard, just, like, waiting to see what was going to happen. One of the pharmacy techs that I was with, he was like this really, really nice guy. And so he would try and help out, even though he didn't really know much about nursing or ER or anything like that. He just took care of drugs and supplies. And the one time he came in and was like wanted to help, and he noticed that the vehicle, the ambulance that they had come in, was actually a Humvee, was the door was still open. And so he went in there to try and like see if there was another person and let them know, hey, somebody will be out to get you shortly, and then he was going to come let somebody know. So he went out and he, you know, touched the guy in the leg and said, you know, somebody would be out here, just hold on a minute. And then he realized that the guy was dead. Well, totally freaked him out because he'd never seen a dead person before in his life. And yeah, that traumatized him for a while after that because he kept talking about it. And then a couple weeks after that, we sent him to the supply tent to get something that we were short on. And he walked in there, and that was our temporary morgue. Well, in this group that had come in, there were some casualties. And so he walked in on like three bodies in the supply tent and just about lost it. He was like, I am not a medical person, even though people think I am. You know, I'm a supply tech. I shouldn't have to deal with this type of stuff. I mean, he like, so it was interesting to see how different people reacted to it. Some people were just like, oh yeah, this is no big deal. I worked in downtown Chicago at an inner city ER. And then you'd have other people that worked in a clinic, and that was their experience as a nurse before they came in. So it was very interesting to watch other people's reactions to things. For me, it was just kind of like, oh, whatever they throw at me, I'm just going to take care of it. So I didn't get too high-strung about anything. It was more, I was going to enjoy it the best that I could and learn the most that I could from everything. So I asked, like, thousands of questions. That was usually my way of dealing with things. The more I knew, the more I felt like I was in control of things. And then it wasn't so scary then.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, that's how you got through every day, was just, like, learning more.
Yep. Because then you're focused on learning. You're not focused on the fact that your patient is missing an arm, or, you know, you're focused on, so what am I going to have to do for this person? Or, you know, how am I going to make sure that they get out of here? How am I going to control their pain? You don't, I mean, I had guys that would ask me for, can I have a mirror? I want to see what I look like. And it's like, oh, no, I don't really think that you want. So you'd lie and be like, I'm sorry, I don't have a mirror with me, I can't. Because it's like, you don't want the first time for them to see that their face has been all scarred and blown up from shrapnel to be right now when they're in the middle of their healing process. I was like, But there was, you know, it was hard though telling groups that one of their guys didn't make it. Because you could tell they were all very, very close-knit groups.
So how long were you in Jordan on that base?
That deployment, I was there for 3 months. At approximately, I don't know, 2.5 months, they decided that they were going to forward deploy half the group into Iraq. And then half of us were going to go back. And I was originally going to be part of the group that went forward, but the deployment was causing significant marital strain for me, so they felt that I needed to go home and take care of my family life, so they wouldn't let me. I actually volunteered to go forward, and they wouldn't let me.
Oh, really? Yeah. You wanted to go into Iraq?
Yeah. I didn't want to go home and deal with my husband, so Plus, by that point, I felt very comfortable with the people that I was over there with, and I got used to the way of life over there. I mean, there's not as many politics. It's, you do what you need to do to take care of your patients, and that's like your whole focus. Where stateside, you know, you have to worry about the Joint Commission, and you have to worry about the state coming in and inspecting you. And, you know, I guess the military is not the state, but normally you have all these regulations and paperwork and all this other stuff that you have to worry about. And over there, it's just, you take care of your patients.
A lot more straightforward.
Yeah. It's more like, and you have to be creative because, you know, sometimes half your supplies wouldn't show up or it was going to be another couple weeks until they were going to get there. So you had to, like, figure out a way to be able to take care of them with what you had. So it felt kind of like you had to be more creative about things. So it was actually kind of cool. I'm one of those nurses who likes to make my own rules. So I fit very well in the deployed environment.
So you ended up going back to Travis?
So I went back to Travis. At that point, my nurse manager was back, and they were starting to expand the ICUs because we were having more and more patients. We would occasionally get them from overseas that would be flown back. But then I came back and I worked in the ICU for a while. I divorced my husband. And then I had just started dating somebody else. And a year later found out that I was going to be going back again. So that time I volunteered. I had requested to go. I had wanted to go earlier, but they wouldn't let me. There was a guy who had, his wife was pregnant and was expecting, I think it was their third child. And so I volunteered to go in his place because we had all of the same credentials and qualifications and everything. And they wouldn't allow me. They told me it was his turn. So I was a little bit frustrated by some of that kind of stuff. I had friends of mine who would have children that were, you know, 6 weeks old and they'd be deployed 2 or 3 days later. And that was actually what made me decide to get out of the military. I knew I wanted a family at some point, and I didn't want to have to be worried about, you know, are they going to send me away from my kids? So I decided that it was better for me to just get out. Plus, the politics were starting to get to me. So I didn't like having to do what they told me to because they told me to. I wasn't very good at that. I mean, my boss I could handle, but sometimes the hospital would decide to do things that just didn't make any sense. It was like they didn't check with the people who actually are the ones implementing the stuff, and it would get frustrating. Yeah. And then I found out that I was, because I'd been in ICU for 4 years, that I was going to have to do a different kind of nursing, and I didn't want to leave ICU, so.
So let's talk about your second deployment.
Okay.
So did you go to Iraq then?
Yep, the second time I was in Iraq, I was at Tulail Air Force Base in southern Iraq by Nasiriya. That was more of a typical Air Force deployment. We had, you know, 4 or 5 people to a tent. I had an actual bed, which was amazing after having a cot the first time around. I had laundry facilities, there was a gym, there was a theater, they had like all sorts of stuff for entertainment. And Air Force Tent City was walled off from the rest of the base. So you had to actually have an Air Force ID card to be able to get in and out of that area, or you had to be with somebody. So they wouldn't allow just anyone in there, which was kind of interesting because, you know, the Army people always wanted to come over and use the laundry or whatever, and we weren't allowed to let them over because otherwise there wasn't enough for the Air Force people. But, so that deployment, our living situation was a lot better. But I was, it was a lot more difficult for me the second time around because there were only 2 of us from Travis that were sent. We were added onto a team out of Lackland. And so I didn't know anybody at all. At least the first time around, I had like met a couple of them, worked with a couple of them, kind of had an idea who people were. Second time, it was very clicky. It was like the group from Lackland already knew each other. They all hung out. They didn't need another person to hang out with them. And my first couple weeks, like, wrote lots of letters, lots of emails, and watched lots of movies, and then I finally met one of the girls in my tent, Michelle, discovered that she used to go over to the Italian Tent City on a regular basis. And so she invited me to go over there with her. And so I met all of these Italians, like nurses and doctors and pilots and stuff. And so then I started spending the majority of my time over there. Once I got to know those guys, then it was fine. You know, I had like a group of friends that I could talk to about things when bad things would happen at work or whatever, somebody that I could just kind of unload. And yeah, but it was completely different. Because we had so many options of things to do, people weren't as close to each other. They didn't talk, they didn't, you know, it was very different. Plus, that group definitely treated me like she's an officer and we can't talk to her. Whereas the first group, it didn't matter what rank you were, everybody was kind of friends with everybody. And when you were at work, you definitely respected whoever was in charge. But outside of work, we were all just kind of, we didn't call each other, you know, captain or anything like that. Second deployment, they treated me like I was different.
What was your rank by this time?
I was captain, or I made captain, actually, during my second deployment. So, yeah, they just, it was one of those, ooh, she's an officer, we can't talk to her. And all of the other officers were, you know, married and had kids, and their whole focus was going back to their tent and writing letters to their kids or calling their kids or, you know, I mean, that. Whereas I didn't have a family to keep in touch with, so I wanted to, like, go out and explore and do things and whatnot. So it was different. I did get to do some cool things, though. They let me go off base to go volunteer to see some of the Bedouin families in the area. We would bring them water and food and basic medical supplies. So, like, I would, explain to them what their medications were for. And if they had a wound or something like that, take a look at it and maybe give them some band-aids or explain to them how to clean it. The little kids were the cutest, though. I mean, they'd come up and they'd be, like, sticking their hands out because they wanted candy. So they're used to the soldiers bringing candy. But all of the Iraqi people that I met were very thankful that we were there. They were terrified because that was at the time when al-Sadr and his men had overthrown the Italian stronghold in Nasiriyah. And so there was tons of unrest and things going on down there. And they felt safer knowing that we were close by. But they didn't want to speak up against al-Sadr because he could, you know, at some point be the political leader in the area. And they didn't want to upset him and end up being killed because of that. So it was interesting. I appreciated being able to go off base and see what the Bedouins, their lifestyle is just so different. I mean, they live in tents that typically it's just a top and there's no sides to it. The more well-to-do Bedouin families would have like donkeys and chickens and stuff like that that they would kind of cart around with them. They were all really, really short. I mean, nobody came up past my shoulders. And the women were funny though. They came up and they were all trying to touch my face. They wanted to know what they could do to be able to make their face so white because they thought it was beautiful. Wanted to know if they could use some special creams or something. So, I mean, it was interesting to see how somebody else lived. Kept offering us food, but based on the way the kitchen looked, I didn't feel comfortable eating the food. And there were flies everywhere, just tons and tons and tons of flies. But then when we'd have the dust storms come through, or the flooding, we had serious flooding for a while. I'd think about, you know, I wonder how they deal with that, you know. They have no sides to their tent, there's no protection from the wind. And like, I couldn't even get it took two of us to be able to get the front door of our tent open because the wind was blowing so hard against it. And you didn't even know where you were going. But if you didn't have the basketball court on the floor, on the ground, to be able to kind of know which direction you were walking in, there's no way I would have known where the hospital was. They really had to go to the bathroom, so I had to go out in the middle of it.
Because of the sand blowing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be just really thick. You'd have to wear your goggles and like wear a thing over your mouth so you didn't inhale all of it. Yeah, the dust storms were crazy.
Wow. Was it safe for you to go off base to go visit the veterans, or was it pretty dangerous?
It was dangerous. We went with security forces and had to be all, I had to wear full armor and all that, but it wasn't anywhere near as dangerous as if I would do helicopter transports for patients. So, like, if we had a patient that needed transport up to Baghdad or wherever, maybe they needed a CT scanner or something like that that we didn't have, they would typically choose a nurse to go with, because a nurse can run the ventilator and the medications and monitor the patient and stuff. Well, I was the lightest of all of the nurses over there that could do all of those things. So I would often be able to go on the helicopter flights to transport the patients. And normally, you know, on your way up to Baghdad, you're not paying attention to anything else because you're so busy focused on your patient and keeping them sedated and everything. But then once you drop off your patient, you start hearing explosions around the base that you're at, and they're like, we need to get out of here before dusk, because it's going to get a lot worse. And you're like, oh, okay, this is a little bit more dangerous than you, because you weren't even thinking about that when you left. And then you realize that, yeah, they gave you a gun, and they made sure you had a copy of your orders with you and your ID cards and stuff before they took off. And I'm like, oh, God. So, yeah, my first flight, I had asked some of the techs to get me breakfast because I had gotten up a little bit late. And so they were supposed to be bringing me back breakfast. Well, then they got a call that we had some casualties coming in. So they weren't able to bring me some breakfast, but I wasn't that concerned about it. So the guy came into the ER, and they determined that he was going to need to go up to Baghdad. So I was the one who got chosen to go with him. And so by the time I flew him up there and got back, it was like 5 o'clock in the evening. I still had 2 more hours of my shift left. But I hadn't eaten breakfast or lunch, and I was like completely dehydrated because it's like 130 degrees, and I had all of my armor on and was flying in a helicopter where there's lots of dust and wind and stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, I thought I was going to die by the time I got back. I'm so hungry and so thirsty, but like exhilarated at the same time. It's like, I don't know, there's nothing comparable to flying in a helicopter. I didn't even care if we were being shot at, or actually the birds were more dangerous than the people. But they fly really, really low so that people can't see them coming up. And so you can actually see the faces of people as you're flying over them. It's kind of freaky. But, and then you'd be out in the middle of nowhere, and they'd be just like desert. Nothing around for miles. You'd see people out walking.
Really?
Yeah, on their Mecca, their religious Mecca.
Wow.
And I'm like, that's just insane. I cannot imagine just being out here walking in the middle of nowhere trying to, it's crazy.
So it sounds like you, I mean, even though you're in the middle of a war zone, you were so into it, like your job and what you had to do, that it didn't disturb you as much as it could have.
No. Yeah, I was a lot more focused on my patients. I mean, there were sometimes the patients, it would bother me. We had 2 young Iraqi boys who, scrap metal is like a hot commodity in Iraq. They sell it. So anytime that the military puts out any sort of metal anywhere, whether it's like concertine wire, they go and they chop it up and then they take it back and they sell it. So one day the army was out blowing up old tanks so that they couldn't be used again. Like, there were old Iraqi tanks. And they made sure that there was nobody around when they were blowing them up. But so they had the initial explosion. Well, then all these kids ran in to grab the scrap metal, and it exploded again. So two of them were severely burned, like 50%, and were transported to us. And I knew that they weren't going to make it. I mean, even if we could have flown them back to Germany for further treatment, 50% burns in that kind of environment, I mean, they're going to get infected and they're going to end up dying. And we wanted to try and let the family on base to be able to come say goodbye to them before something happened. And the commander wouldn't allow it because this was when all the unrest was going on with Al-Sadr. and they didn't feel comfortable having anybody additional on base than necessary. We had just been bombed. It wasn't long before that. So they were very nervous about letting people on. So we ended up making an arrangement with the local Iraqi hospital to transport these two kids back to them in exchange for donating a couple of ventilators. So they each went in different ambulances. The one ambulance was so old that it wouldn't even start, so we ended up having to push start the ambulance to be able to get it to go. That was really sad. And then, so we got off to the edge of the base, and we met the Iraqi ambulance crew that was going to be taking them from there. And I didn't realize that in Iraq, it's just a driver. There's nobody in the back of the ambulance with the person. So I had to put this child, and he was like 14, in the back of an ambulance and strap him down with his ventilator and all of his drips to keep him asleep and comfortable. And pray to God that he doesn't go over a bump and like the ventilator becomes disconnected so he can't breathe anymore, or his arm kinks off one of the medications and he wakes up. Or I'm like, it was like not a very cool experience to have to make them be like that, because you knew that they weren't going to make it. And I just kept hoping that they were going to be able to, their parents were going to see them before they die.
Did you ever find out what happened?
No, you never really found out anything. I mean, we had suicide attempts, and we had a guy who had a massive heart attack. We had all sorts of things, but you never had any clue what happened to him afterwards. That was probably the hardest part. There was no follow-up. There was no way of knowing if they made it or not.
So was your base getting bombed while you were there, too?
We only got bombed once. And it was in the middle of the night. I was sound asleep, and I was really, really sick. I was, like, running a fever and throwing up my guts. I was in serious pain. And so when the bomb went off, you know, all of us in our tent were like, was that a bomb? Because the sirens didn't go off right away. So we're all like, I think we should probably get on the floor. And so, you know, I was so sick that I just kind of rolled off of my bed and pulled my flak vest and just set it on top of me with my helmet, because I didn't feel well. And my only thought was, I don't feel well enough today to take care of people. Please don't let this be happening today. I can't deal with it today. I mean, I had no concern for myself being blown up or anything like that. It was all just, I can't take care of people today. Today's not a good day for me. But it was kind of weird, though. I mean, when it hit, you could see the sides of the tent suck in and out. That's how close it was.
Wow.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, even though it only happened once, for a long time after that, anytime I would hear loud noises, I would roll on the floor. And you just kind of, it got, like, programmed into my brain. And, because I was on call 24/7 and constantly being woken up in the middle of the night to come in, because for a while I was the only ICU nurse there. The other one was forward deployed, so I took care of everything anytime anything came in. I lost the ability to sleep real deep because I was kind of always on alert waiting for somebody to wake me up.
Yeah, like you can't relax totally, you're just always in that zone where you're awake.
Yeah,
almost
listening for footsteps or whatever. So even today, I sleep with earplugs and a fan because I'm so sensitive to noise. Somebody will close a car door outside and I'm like wide awake, heart racing, thinking that I need to go respond to something. And it's like, no, I'm at home asleep. So it's kind of weird how, you know, I mean, I guess for 6 months between the two deployments, it was 3 months each deployment. That's, you know, you're on call all the time.
Yeah. It's amazing, too, that you were the only ICU nurse that was there.
Yeah, tell me about it. There's supposed to be four in our group, and the one hospital just didn't have any ICU nurses that they could send. One was replaced with an ER nurse, and then there was myself and John, and they needed John up north. and I can't remember where he ended up going. But he's got all these cool pictures of him touring Saddam's palaces. So they sent him forward, and just I stayed behind. And that was, of course, when everything started happening, and we started having lots of really sick and critical casualties come in. So, I mean, they would tell me, like, I had a patient on a ventilator, and they're like, oh, well, you could just, you know, train one of the other nurses to be able to watch your patient so you can go home and get some sleep. And I'm like, you don't understand. ICU medicine is a very specialized type of medicine. I can teach somebody how to physically, you know, manually turn the dials and stuff and run a ventilator, but I can't explain to them all the intricacies of when you go up on the PEEP or when you change the tidal volume or how you know to do. I can't teach somebody how to do that in a day. So it's a lot of it is very intuitive.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they would want me to take a clinic nurse and teach them to be an ICU nurse in a couple of days, and I'm like, it's not going to happen. I mean, they can help me, and they can get my vital signs for me, and they can do some of these things, but so much of it is critical thinking skills and observation, knowing what you're looking for, but it's so intuitive that I don't even know what it is that I'm looking for until I see it. So, yeah, that was I think he was gone for like a month. It was a very long month. I was very glad when he came back. Yeah. So.
So you said you were there for 3 months?
Yep, 3 months. 3 months each deployment, so a total of 6 months.
Are there any other stories you can think of from that deployment that would be interesting to share?
It's like I have like all sorts of weird little things. Like I, you know, have pictures that run through my head of, you know, the one night I was out at the Italian place with my friend Michelle. And I hate seafood. I'm not a seafood person. So Michelle disappeared for a while and she came back out and she had this big, it was like this huge fish. She put a pair of sunglasses on it and I brought it out and she was dancing with the fish, trying to convince me that the fish was harmless and that I would be perfectly fine eating the fish and that if I would just try it, I would like him. And he was very sad because I didn't like him. She like did this whole comedy routine. And I was just like, oh my gosh, you can tell it's been a stressful week. Because that's, you know, that's how you relax. You do stupid things and kind of blow off steam that way. I know my second deployment, I was so sick for a couple weeks there that it's like, that was like the worst part of my whole deployment. They accused me of drinking alcohol and saying that I got pancreatitis from drinking. So they tested me for alcohol poisoning. And of course it came back negative because I didn't drink at all my second deployment. We weren't allowed to. And I was not going to throw away my commission. And at the time I was still considering going to Germany. I wasn't going to throw that away for a drink.
Right.
It just wasn't going to happen. So I was really, 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 really pissed off at the military during that deployment for testing me and not asking me about it first. Because if they would have asked me, I would have had no problem with it. But they did it behind my back. And then my records disappeared for a while, so I couldn't even look at them. I was very upset with my commander. He was very paternalistic, and I was the only unmarried female officer for my second deployment. So he kind of acted like he needed to protect me and be my father. And so he would actually put restrictions on me and say, you need to be back, you know, in tent city by such and such a time, and you need to sign out and tell me where you're going. And I was so mad because he didn't do it to everybody. It was just me. And then he realized that he couldn't do it to just me, so then it was all of the females. And then he was told that that was racist, or sexist. So he finally said that everybody needed to write a law. But Michelle and I were the only two that were talked to when we came in late, or his version of late. You know, I never missed work, and I was always at work on time and fully functional. And so I was told that I needed to be careful of those men, the Italians, because of their reputation. And I'm like, they were a lot nicer to me than the Army guys. You know, Army guys, you would walk past and they would snicker or they would make comments, or you would sit down at lunch and you'd have like 20 guys come up and want to sit next to you. And so the Italians were a lot more respectful than the Army guys. They would get very grabby and, you know, try to put their arm around you, or why don't you come back to my tent, and got a lot of that kind of stuff. So
yeah, I guess that's from being a woman in the military, kind of have those experiences.
Yeah, it is different being a woman. I mean, and unfortunately for me, I'm young, and I'm a woman, and not to sound like I'm bragging, but I was more attractive than a lot of the women that were over there. You know, there weren't many of us, but a lot of them were, you know, they were older, and they were married, and had a couple of kids, and they were in their 40s and 50s. Well, I didn't meet that age group, and I definitely didn't have any kids or anything like that, so I was treated very differently. People acted like I didn't know anything, like I was a dumb blonde, that I, the only reason that I was working in the ICU was because they had no other place to put me. It's like, I would say something, and people would just, like, totally discount it because I'm the one that said it. And I would get so mad. So then I'd have to, like, pull out a textbook or look it up on the internet, or, you know, show them, hey, no, this is actually what the research says. And then they'd be like, oh, okay, well, you know, maybe she knows what she's talking about. But it's like I constantly felt like I had to prove myself, because otherwise people just wouldn't take me seriously. So I did notice a difference, though, going from a lieutenant to a captain. As soon as I hit captain, that seemed to inspire respect in some people. It was like, oh, she's a captain. You know, she must know more. I mean, she's been a nurse for a while. But what they don't realize is, you know, you could have been a nurse for a while and still be a lieutenant because you just came into the military. But they don't think about that.
Right, yeah. So, how did you get home from Iraq?
I'm trying to remember. My first deployment, when I went over, we were on a little cargo.
Okay, so you're talking about the cargo plane?
Yeah. So, it was quite interesting, because they're jump seats. They have, like, two little metal poles sticking out with a little mesh seat in the middle of it. And then your back is right up against the side of the plane. And you're flying sideways. So, when we got there, I couldn't figure out what was going on. It's like my balance was off, and I kept, like, walking funny. And then I found out that it was just my equilibrium was all off from having to sit sideways in the airplane. Yeah, it was bizarre. That time we flew into Qatar, spent the night there, and then they flew us in a really small plane and dropped us off in Jordan. I just remember that smell of, like, gas. I mean, it was a really overwhelming gas smell. A lot of people got sick on their little flight. And they do combat landings. They're, like, crazy. I mean, they basically go straight down and land. So
wow.
You feel like your stomach is, like, dropping out of your body. But it's kind of like being on a roller coaster at the same time. So that was quite interesting. And that time they came out and it was a regular passenger, like a Continental or something like that, that flew us back. They came and picked us up in Jordan. The second time we flew out. I think I flew just a regular passenger flight out to Baltimore. And then from Baltimore, we got on a military hop that took us out to Germany. And then from Germany, we had to get to Qatar. And then we spent a couple of days in Qatar waiting for a flight into Iraq. And that flight, I don't remember as much. But on the way home, we stopped in Qatar also. And they had, you could get, like, a 45-minute massage for $20 or something like that. So I went and got a massage, and I got my nails done and, like, all this stuff. They had, like, all this really cool stuff in Qatar that I was like, oh, my God, I feel like I'm back in civilization again. So I spent my couple of days just relaxing. And then they flew us back to some place around Baltimore. It wasn't there. It was some reserve base. And then bused us to the airport. And it was one of those times when they were having really bad storms on the, like, East Coast. So there were tons of delays and backups. So they just basically said, find whatever way you can to get home. And just keep a copy of all your receipts.
Wow.
So I was traveling with another girl who was also named Brooke. And so our flight was, like, I think we had, like, three different layovers to be able to get from there all the way back to California. And then that was my first time back. Getting them confused. Yeah, it was the first time back because I called my husband and asked him to come pick me up at 9 o'clock at the airport and threw a fit telling me that that was too late. I was like, oh. Then he didn't recognize me at the airport even though I'd only been gone for 3 months.
Wow.
He said he was expecting to see me in my uniform. And he didn't, so he didn't know who I was. I was like, yeah, okay. But, yeah, so it was the first time around when we came back that they dropped us off and just said, figure out your own way back. I was like, okay. But Brooke was very assertive and had no problem, like, pushing to the front of the line to be able to get us a flight. And one of my bags was, like, 97 pounds. And the cutoff is 100 pounds, or they can't take it at all. So it was nice. They didn't charge us any extra for any of our stuff. We went into the bathroom because we'd been flying for a couple of days and we're still in our military uniforms and smelled really, really bad. Went into the bathroom and tried to wash my hair in the sink and was using, like, baby wipes to wash off and put clean clothes on. Threw away the clothes that I had on because it smelled so bad. Yeah, it was interesting. But the second one, we did stop in Baltimore overnight and then I just flew back from there. There wasn't anything weird about that trip.
So how long were you at Travis then after you got back for your second deployment?
I had another year and a half after I got back.
And you just continued to work at the ICU there?
Yep. Kept working in the ICU. Made my decision that I was not going to stay in. Turned in all my separation paperwork and then just kind of bided my time. But unfortunately, that second deployment, that illness that I got, the high fevers and the vomiting and abdominal pain and stuff, it never went away. It got better, but it never completely went away. So when I came back, I went through months and months of testing, and they could never figure out what was wrong. But they finally diagnosed me with fibromyalgia and started me on medication for that, and I finally felt like I was closer to being back to myself. I never completely have been like I was before my deployment. You know, I used to be very active and very involved in lots of different things and, you know, had boundless energy and was always volunteering for things. And now I have to pace myself. I just can't do as much anymore. And but it was kind of nice because my nurse manager at the time was very understanding. And she actually, because I told her I needed regular work hours because I would work days and nights and flip-flop back and forth all the time. She needed somebody to cover down in the GI center for a couple of months. So I got to go work down there. So I was working straight days. And then they needed somebody in the interventional radiology lab for a month. So I got to go work down there for a month. So she did everything she could to try and keep me off the 12-hour shifts and keep me on a day shift so that I could, like, have a regular schedule. So it was kind of cool for me, though, because I got cross-trained to all these different kinds of nursing that ended up being beneficial to me in the end.
So you were able to keep a regular schedule even though you were sick? The medication helped you function?
Yeah. The first couple months, I couldn't. I mean, I thought that I would get up and try to drive to the grocery store and I'd fall asleep at the wheel. And I felt like I had the flu that just wouldn't go away. I hurt everywhere, and I was sick to my stomach every morning, and was having terrible stomach pains, and it was just not fun. Yeah, it took a couple months of them finally saying, oh, maybe there really is something going on. And then I saw somebody else, and he was like, oh, this sounds like fibromyalgia. So I hadn't really believed in it before I got diagnosed. But once I was diagnosed, I found a book that was written by a nurse who has it. And as I was going through and reading all the symptoms, it was like reading a diary about myself. So it finally clicked that, yeah, it wasn't something that I could control completely on my own, that I needed help with it. And so.
Well, it's good that you found a doctor that was willing to diagnose you with it and saw that you had it.
Yeah, because that would have been, I was thinking that I was losing my mind. I thought that I was imagining everything and that I was, you know, that I was crazy. I'm like, I thought I was having a nervous breakdown, that I mean, especially because everybody kept telling me, you're depressed. And I'm like, no, I think I'm too tired to be depressed. I'm not depressed. I want to go out and do things, and I want to read my books, and I want to, you know, have an active life. I just can't physically do it. It's not that I don't have the desire. I just don't have the physical capacity to do it right now. So I would get really pissed off at my doctor if he'd tell me I was depressed, because I'm like, no, I'm frustrated. I want you to figure out what the heck is going on so that I can have my life back.
So you finished out your time at Travis?
Yep. I separated. I had about a month of vacation time saved up. So I left beginning of August and came back to Wisconsin. My grandma was sick, and I wanted to be closer to her and my family, so I decided to move back here.
So then, were you out of the military then? Like, did you get discharged? Or?
I was discharged about a month after I got out. A month after I moved back here. So they went through all the discharge paperwork and everything, but I still was collecting a paycheck and stuff like that for a month.
So how did you feel, like, coming home? And did it feel, like, totally different from what you'd been doing for so long?
I jumped right into a nurse manager position at a brand new hospital. So I jumped right into a nurse manager position. So I was working 80 hours a week. I didn't even have time to think about anything. I did run into some issues where people thought that I was mean or whatever, because I actually made them work and do things. And oftentimes my military side would come out where I'd be like, no, you're going to do this. And I had to learn how to not scare the hell out of people. So I really, really had to work on my learning to ask people to do things rather than telling them, and being more in tune to, you know, how people responded to me, because I was just so used to being able to give an order and having it followed, and it wasn't like that anymore. So that took me some adjustment. The hardest adjustment, though, was actually when I got back from Iraq each time. I think I felt it more the first time than I did the second time, but I don't know quite how to explain it, but I felt like when people looked at me, they should be able to tell that I was different. They should recognize that I had just participated in something, you know, greater than myself. Something, like, I was in the war for my country, and I saw all of these things, and it was like, you know, I felt so different. But I'd be like walking through the grocery store, and they'd be like, these people have no clue what I just went through the last couple months. They have no idea what my life is like. And I remember I got really pissed off because there was a guy that wrote into a magazine saying that people needed to stop putting the support the troops magnets on their car, because if you weren't in the military, you had no clue what it was like to be in the military. And I'm like, you cannot tell by looking at somebody if they are in the military or they were in the military. I mean, Jason, I mean, he looks like he was in the military, especially when he gets his hair cut, and when you watch the way he carries himself, he looks like a military guy. I don't look like I'm part of the military. People don't associate me with the military. And So I got really offended by that because I'm like, you don't know. You don't know. They could have a brother. They could have a sister. They could have somebody. If they want to support the troops as their own, they can do it. But, yeah, I felt very different, and I felt like people should recognize it. And I wanted to share stories. And it was like nobody really got it. You know, like, the second deployment with the Italians. They, their porta potties are way different than ours. It's a hole in the ground, and that's the porta potty. So, you know, me being a medical person was like, well, what happens if you've got the runs? Well, you squat over the hole and pray that you make it in and don't splash it all over your feet. I'm like, oh my God, you know? And, or like the women, that there were not a lot of Italian females, but they had to use the same stalls. So they'd have to like squat over the hole in the floor to be able to go to the bathroom. You know, and I don't know, I felt like I had changed, and I felt like people should notice it, and I felt like people should recognize that. And then I finally realized that, no, I knew that I had changed, I knew that I was a different person, and I just needed to learn that not everybody wanted to hear about it.
So. Was your family pretty understanding when you came home?
Yeah. Yeah. My parents told me that it was going to take me time to adjust. I'm like, no, I'm fine, you know, I'll be perfectly fine. But it really was. You had to adjust to making decisions about what you're going to wear every day. Because you're used to wearing your uniform all the time. You had to make decisions again about what you were going to eat. Because you ate in the cafeteria. I mean, it was like all these things that I didn't have to do for several months. I had to kind of reacclimate myself to doing. Friends that I had before I left had now been, you know, transferred to other bases, or they were deployed now, or it's like my friends were changing every time. So yeah, it was different. Coming back to Wisconsin, I think it helped that I did not move back to Madison right away. That I moved to Wausau, and because the group of friends I had before I left, you know, only one of them ever called me while I was gone. The others, you know, if I was in town, they might, like, you know, stop by to say hi. But nobody ever wanted to see any of my pictures. Nobody ever wanted to hear any of my stories. Nobody ever called me when I was out there. Nobody ever came to visit me. Nobody, you know, and it was like, this is just a phase that Brooke is going through, and she's going to snap out of it and come back someday, was the attitude that I was got. So then when I got out, I didn't want to come back here. I didn't want to be around that same group of people, because I was different, and they were still treating me like I was the same person I was before I left. So, in Wausau, nobody knew me. I was a brand new person, so there was no preconceived ideas of how I should act. But it did make it hard when Jason and I first started dating, because we were friends with the same group of people before we joined the military. We both joined the military. A couple years apart, but we were both in the military, and then we were both separating. So Jason and I have some similar experiences, and we have both changed and grown up. And it's like our friends never left. I don't even think they've gone on vacation outside of Wisconsin since we left. So it's, they judge us differently than they should, but I mean, I can't change the way they think about it. They still compare us to what we used to be like and expect us to go out and do the things that we used to do. It's like I'm not a 22-year-old college kid anymore. So.
Did Jason go to Iraq too?
No. He never was deployed. Okay. So he doesn't understand a lot of the stuff I've been through. He likes to tease me that I'm not part of the real military, but the Air Force is the Air Farce. And that it doesn't really exist as part of the military. It's like a civilian group that just tries to attach themselves. He's Marine Corps, so I mean, that's kind of what they're trained. But then I remind him that I'm the one who was flying around over there, sewing people back up and making sure they made it back home, and he's had a desk here. And then he kind of shuts up. But, yeah.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, you had such unique experiences that most people have to relate to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would think so. I mean, I think that they're interesting things, you know, some of the stuff. And I've got pictures, and I still have to put a lot of them in an album. But, you know, I mean, it's different things. And like the Bedouins, who else is going to be able to go out and visit Iraqi people and talk to them and find out, you know, their what their life is like? I mean, that's completely different. Or, you know, stationed with the Italians and the Koreans. I mean, I had one Spanish troop that came through as a patient, and he didn't speak any English, and the ophthalmologist was Korean, and he didn't speak any English. So basically, the patient would talk to me in Spanish, I would translate it to the Korean nurse in English, and then she would take it from English and translate it into Korean for the doctor.
Wow.
I mean, it was crazy, you know, but there was so many different cultures.
We're talking about cultures. Different.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to meet that many different cultures in such a short period of time in any other way. I mean, my first deployment, the Australians were there. Second deployment, it was Koreans and Polish and, you know, you name it, people from all different sorts of countries were coming through there. So, yeah, so it was a wonderful learning experience for me. Got to learn more. We had an entire Asian Pacific heritage party to learn more about the Korean culture, and they had like Korean food and Korean dancing, and couldn't understand anything that the people were saying to me, but I could understand that they wanted pictures with the American girls with blonde hair. That was about as much as I could get out of it.
That's cool. So after you left the service, you said you went back to work. You're working 80 hours a week, and I know that you went back to school, too.
Yep, I'm going back to school for my master's degree. I figured with the GI Bill, I really needed to take advantage of it. And for me, with all my health problems, I can't work full-time as a staff nurse very easily anymore. The 80 hours a week as a nurse manager, I loved my job, absolutely loved it, but I couldn't do it. I mean, because that was all I did. I didn't have any other life. I would go home and go to sleep, get up, go back to work, go home and go to sleep, get up and go back to work.
Yeah.
I just didn't have the energy to do anything more than that. So, right now I'm back. I have 3 more classes until I get my master's in nursing education.
And then you're going to try to teach?
Yeah, I think. I haven't quite figured that out yet. I want to start a family. So I'm getting married in December, and then we want to start having kids. And so that'll kind of make a difference in what I decide to do as a job, because I don't want to work full-time. I mean, as it is, I know that there are going to be days that I'm going to be too tired to take care of my kids, and that scares the heck out of me. So I want a job that's going to be flexible enough that it doesn't take too much out of me, so I can spend time with my family and be a good mom.
So do you get any veterans benefits? Or?
I do. Because I'm within my 5 years of getting out, I get care at the VA because I was part of Operation Iraqi Freedom. But then I just recently received my disability compensation, so I'm considered 50% disabled. And that takes care of my medical care for anything that's service-related, which, considering I was spending several thousand dollars a year on medical care, I was very happy when that came through.
And did you get any medals or citations?
I got the Air Force Achievement Medal for Meritorious Service. And then the rest of them were, you know, the Global War on Terrorism and some of those. I don't remember what all I have. I think I have 6 of them.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, have you attended any reunions at all?
No.
No?
No, I haven't. There was some big thing this summer for Iraqi war vets, but I haven't been back to that. And it's like I still keep in touch with a couple of the people that I was stationed with out at Travis, but all of us have gotten out of the military now, so it's different.
Looking back, how do you feel about the whole thing? Like, what has it meant to your life?
It has changed my life in many ways. I don't regret having gone into the service. I learned so much about myself and about people and about commitment. You know, I learned that
there's, you know, the military, it was something much bigger than myself. It was something that I didn't always understand what we were doing or why we were doing it or anything like that, but you just, you had to do it because somebody made that decision that that was the right thing to do. And knowing that I was making sure that those guys made it home to their families, or at least back to Germany, was a great feeling. You know, it was one of those things that it gave you a really strong sense of pride, and it made you feel like what you were doing was worth it. You know, just to make sure that they got home. That was like my whole goal. And then I think of all the special training and the advanced classes and some of that kind of stuff that the military allowed me to attend that I wouldn't have had the opportunity to in the civilian world because I'm a nurse. And they're designed primarily for doctors. So I had a much greater understanding of ICU medicine than most civilian nurses ever would. So I like that. But at the same time, it took a lot out of me. You know, my health has suffered significantly after being in the military. And I don't know if it's related to the virus that I got. I don't know if it's emotional trauma. I don't know exactly what caused all of it. I just know that I was a very healthy person, and then I joined the military, and now I'm not. So that has been the hardest thing, and that's the thing that I regret about it. I wish I still had boundless energy like I used to.
Is there anything else that you can think of that you wanted to talk about that I haven't asked you about?
No, nothing I could think of off the top of my head. I don't know. I think that the military is a great organization, and I think that everybody should have the opportunity to serve, not necessarily for 4 years or anything like that, but for a year or two, just to understand what it's all about. Because, you know, with people protesting the war and everything like that, I'm glad that they have not lost support for the troops, because as a person in the military, I stayed as far away from politics as I possibly could, because you didn't want to have a side. You wanted to just do what you were told. And a lot of young people today don't get that. They don't understand. And then there's the discipline. I mean, you cannot call in sick to work. You show up to work throwing up or dying, and then they determine that you can go home. There is no such thing as, I just don't feel like I'm going to go to work today. And respecting your elders. You do not talk back. You do not sass anybody. I mean, they really do instill with you a lot of values that I think would be good for a lot of the youth today. I mean, having been a nurse manager, a lot of the people that worked for me, it's like they had no respect for anybody. It was all about them, and they couldn't see beyond their own little world. So it really does open up your eyes. That's it.
Well, thank you for the interview.
Thank you.
And thank you for your service.
Thanks.